I confess I find it a little intimidating to come before Gil Fonsdale students, specialists in shamatha and vipassana, well trained, I'm sure, in the slippery monkey of the mind.
Can everyone hear? If you could get closer to the microphone, it needs about 2 inches from you, you really need
that. How's that? Good morning. Well, it is an honor for me to be here, and particularly on this occasion of the 2,600 and something anniversary of the enlightenment of Shakyamuni Buddha. We've been sitting at Green Gulch beginning last Sunday, our usual what's called Rohatsu Seishin, the 7 days of intensive sitting that all Zen monasteries and others do around the world at this time of the year to commemorate something called an awakening in the world, a kind of an epiphany, or to mark, to pick out even arbitrarily, a moment in time exemplified by a character, a personification, if you will, even a projection, perhaps, of our need to awaken into the largest dimension of our birthright. I suppose all of you are familiar with the story, but if you don't mind, I'd like to tell it again, a little bit, from various points of view. You know, we don't know, of course, that this is the time that some event, some epiphany like this took place. Characteristically, Christmas, the Saturnalia, the resurrection, and so on, take place around the changes of the light, the equinoxes, the solstices. So I think this time of year is a good one when at least in the northern hemisphere, the night force will begin to diminish, and the enlightenment will again occur. Certainly our ancient ancestors sitting in their caves in dark forests look forward to this time of year when miraculously light would return. So maybe it has something to do with that, too. So what is this story about somebody born with a golden spoon in his mouth, or a silver spoon in his or her mouth? What is it to be born in the midst of privilege, which is interesting on the one hand, because there's another fable about somebody who's born in a stable on another side of the story, in poverty. This is that aspect of ourselves where we're born with all the privileges that the so-called material world can provide for us, with parents who care, a father whose son is predicted by the soothsayer, Atista at least, was, you know, in the Indian tradition, came upon the scene when Shakyamuni was born, of course, according to the legend, miraculously, and predicted a brilliant future for him. He had all the marks of greatness, of being a great leader. Either a great spiritual leader, he said, or a great political, a great king. And naturally, the father wanted him to stay in the family business and not leave home. And so he was particularly careful in guarding this youth from those influences that would draw him away from the future that he hoped would be laid down for him, Suddhodana, his father. When Buddha was born, according to one of the stories, we find in the early suttas. And you know it well, I'm sure. He took seven steps, you know. First thing he did is walk out from the womb, take seven steps and point to the sky and to the earth and said, in perfect, already perfect language, grammatical language, above the earth and below the heaven, I alone in the world honored one. Above the heavens also sometimes it said, and below the earth, I alone in the world honored one. I alone in the world honored one. And I just want to ask you, do we have the world honored one with us today? Sitting here? Do you have any question about who that world honored one is? Is there any one of us who is not the world honored one? Is what he was saying. Is there anyone who can be you? Is there anyone who will ever again be the particularity that is oneself? Is there anyone here for whom the whole universe, as we understand it, has not come forth to give you everything you are? Or another way of looking at it, how does the whole universe recognize itself but as you, looking back at it? I alone am the world honored one. Each of us is the world honored one, without question. But maybe there is a question. If he was the world honored one, then what was the big problem? If he was already awakened to that reality, then why did he have to leave home? Apparently he forgot it. Apparently we all forget that bright moment of knowing that we are the world-honored one. There's another story that at some point in his growing up process, before puberty, I guess, when he was 8 or 9, there was a festival. A spring festival, planting festival, in which his father, the king, and one of the ministers, or maybe a farmer, would plow the first row and plant the seeds for the coming harvest, for the coming crops, that in the Shakya clan, in the particular area, that they would have to grow that year to feed themselves. And of course, there's been all these ancient rituals around the growth of food and the production of food, the necessity for growing food and maintaining ourselves in an agricultural community. And so there was much color and hubbub and celebration and dancing and music and singing, and you can imagine how colorful it is. You can imagine Hollywood doing that, putting that one on. Maybe Keanu Reeves again would play the part. Or maybe this young kid who's in all these movies these days. Maybe he'd be a good part for it. Anyway, he finds it a little disconcerting to notice that as they're plowing the fields, that the plow is turning up, cutting into the earth itself, and not only that, but is cutting up earthworms and in half and other creatures that live in the earth, and birds are swooping down to eat these creatures. And larger birds of prey, like hawks and falcons, are descending on those smaller birds and eating them. He finds that upsetting. There must have come a time in each of our lives as we were growing up when we understood that life fed on life. What was that moment when we realized that? What was the moment when you chomped into a steak that you made the connection that the juice is running out over the blood of some animal that you had called a mukau only a few years before and had felt some affection for? Whether we forget that moment or not, at least in our sensitivity, at some time we've all recognized the fact that life feeds on life. Or Shakespeare said, or Hamlet, we fat all creatures else to fat us, and we fat ourselves for maggots. The world is a great recycling system. (Clears throat) So some kind of dissatisfaction grew in him, some kind of anxiety, some kind of existential angst about being in this dimension. Not only that, but everything seemed to be changing around him. Couldn't get hold of anything. In spite of the teachings of the Vedas that he was schooled in, and in spite of all of the athletic contests, and in spite of all of the partying and dancing and music and archery and martial arts skills and political skills and so on that he was trained in, there was some aspect of it that didn't quite fit. I think he, even before this, so he saw the archetypes of old age, sickness, and death, as most of us know about that aspect of his story. Even before that, he certainly must have realized that what you get, you lose. Sooner or later, you're going to lose everything that you consider important. Not only that, but I am being raised, he thinks, to be a great king. That man over there is my servant. That one over there is a serving dancing girl. That one is a farmer. What is this thing about identity? We have these roles. Of course, he was thinking about the acculturation process that goes on with each of us. Rousseau said, everyone is born, wasn't it Jean-Jacques Rousseau who said, all beings or all men are born free when everywhere they're in chains? I think it was Shakyamuni, or that aspect of us who realized that we're all born in chains and think we're free. Well, whether you've seen the movie or the movies or read it in a book or not, there is that scene where suddenly he's faced with the starkness of old age, sickness, and death as presented to him by people in the town outside of his villas. And now the dissatisfaction is even more central, more pressing. He also sees a holy man, doesn't he? He also sees a bhikshu walking. Who are those people? And he's told, well, that's a person with leprosy, and that's what we're all coming to. That old guy and that one on the gnat burning and being wailed over by his, that's a corpse, and so forth. And to this end must we come. How can he be happy then? How can we be happy faced with that? Everything is passing, and you know, grasping at pleasures from moment to moment. The identity did not satisfy him, obviously. I don't think your identities satisfy you either, or you wouldn't be here. That's a whole other talk. See, we're Shakyamuni, every one of us. We all go through this. We all crave, we all search for the answers to the great existential questions of birth and death, without exception. And of course, on the one hand, we try to bury it in the world. There's a lot of diversions out there. A lot of ways to hide from this existential anxiety that we have. Of course, what his parents said, it would be a good idea to marry the boy off, give him some responsibilities, and then maybe he'll settle down and won't worry so much about it. And so they do, and you know, there's a story where he wins the contest, the wrestling, I think it's wrestling, anyway, some kind of contest, and the gold medal, as it were, is given to him by his future wife, Yashodhara. Of course, she's depicted as being everything that a young man in the full bloom of puberty would want. But it's not enough. Interestingly enough, she too, in many of the suttas and stories, is a very awakened person. In fact, in some of the suttas, it says that on the night that of the party, when he decides that he's going to leave, they've already discussed this, she lays out his clothes for him, his traveling clothes. She tells his servant to get the horse, his favorite horse, ready, and so on. And there is another sutta that says that his enlightenment and her enlightenment took place exactly at the same time. Are you familiar with that one? There's one in the Sarvastivadin teachings that on the night that he leaves, he sleeps with her and she becomes pregnant. And for the next 6 years, she carries the baby. And on the night of his enlightenment, the baby is born, Rahula. That they go through the same. It's very interesting that this is not some guy leaving the old lady and the kid to go off and search for nirvana, but that, in fact, this is a co-event that is not a gender-oriented occasion in the world, whatever else the traditions may have made of it, according to their culture. So whether she helps him or not, I like to think that it was an event that she knew he had to go and find the answers and that she would have to find her awakening within the milieu, that the environment that was part of her karma, her way, her path. And we know, you know, about the story that he leaves and cuts off his hair and sends the horse back with a servant, and that there's much lamentation and suffering at back at the palaces that were left to him by his parents. They had three of them, according, a summer palace, a winter palace, ones for the rains, and so on. He leaves all of that, crosses into Magadha, another clan's area, and wanders about for a while and meets a monk who says, "I know the teacher for you. If you want to practice meditation, come with me." And he goes to meet this meditation master who says, "I can help you to sit in meditation and overcome all duality." And he does. And the several practices that they do, and because he is Siddhartha, he is the chosen one, he accomplishes in almost no time what it takes most of his lifetimes to do, which is to sit so still that the separation between self and other becomes obliterated or becomes obviated or becomes subsumed into a whole. It's not enough. He comes, no matter how deep the trance, he comes back down from the jhana and so on. And he leaves that teacher. He goes to another teacher who teaches, he can teach him even more, that the perception of oneness, even that can, is still a sticking point. I can teach you to overcome even oneness, to jump clear of the sense of belonging to all things or all things as you or whatever. However we wanted to put a very complex so-called state of mind, because it was still a state of mind. Whatever state of mind it was would have a birth, would have a certain longevity, would have an ending to it. He was not satisfied. The first teacher, Alara Kalama, he left. He was an old man. The second one, Udaka Rudapata. Another one that begged him to stay with him, and he, after he had mastered all of the what we would call shamatha, vipassana, zen, call it whatever, they were not satisfying to him. Was there such a thing as Brahman? Was there such a unmoving realization? Was there an eternal self or not? I ask you this question. Try to remember a time you weren't here. Of course, it's impossible. You can say, "I can't remember a time I wasn't here." But of course, if you look for "I" or "here," You can't find it yet at the same time. I can't remember a time I wasn't here. I know I won't be here, and I know what I call I is constantly arising and disappearing and vanishing. And I know, it doesn't take much sophistication, that we are an independent, interdependent organism called a universe or a world. I can see that. That's easy to see. I can see that there's not necessarily any self that I can grasp hold of. At the same time, I'm here, and the world is here. How is that? What is that? I want to know that. I want to know what is here that never moves. I want to know the one over and against which all of this is happening, if there is such a one. I want to know that, he thinks. Or I, my story is, this is my story about what I think he thinks. So finally, you know, he decides that, well, maybe what I need to do is, I've still got too much, my perceptions, my sensory equipment is still too sharp. There was a long tradition, of course, already in India, as we know, of asceticism. You know, really, it still is. Really deny the body, punish this thing that stands between me and the eternal. All the craving that comes from the senses, the sight, the smell, the taste, the touch, and so on. Bring that to an end, and then maybe, at last, that of which there is no witcher will finally be revealed to me. So he tries everything, right? He doesn't eat but one mustard seed a day. He becomes skin and bones, his hair grows down to his knees. He never bathes. He was a mess. This lasts several months. All of this has taken place over almost 6 years now, according to what the story is. Now, I know this is probably all old hat to you, but I find every time I hear this, I think it's amazing, because in some way, somehow, each of us is doing this in our own way. If I'm a little footnote here, because there is an ascetic side to us as well as a worldly side to us. There is that side that wants to be somebody, that wants to fulfill him, herself, within the natural day-to-day confines of the living world, to have an identity, to feel fulfilled, to be happy, all those things, not very natural. To be somebody special, to be validated, to have your paper stamped by the world, that that's just who you are. And of course, you know, most of us are never really big somebodies in the sense of the public eye. We're not, fortunately, the president, maybe, or a movie star or something like that. Nor are we maybe great ascetics or saints, you know. We're kind of mediocre, actually, most of us. We kind of are in between. I'm not the Marquis de Sade on the one hand, and I'm not Saint Francis on the other, or Dogen Zenji, or Shakyamuni. But I have those tendencies. The world is driving me nuts, and I want to get away from it. I can't stand it anymore. There must be some answer to all of this. You pull back. You go to a place. They say, sure, you can, let's teach you. Cut off your hair, put on these robes, and follow this schedule. Do all of these kind of things. And after a few weeks, if not a few weeks and a few months, and the novelty wears off, you think, what is this about? Sitting in a forest under a mango tree or something, ice cold, or in a monastery someplace with sore knees staring at a wall. Hungry, haven't had chocolate in a year, haven't had any of the things that you like. What did I ever leave the world for? This is terrible. I'm going to leave this and go back. But when you go back, you remember why you had left it in the first place. But now it's even worse, because now you have a little bit of sensitivity to what something else is like. Now you're really caught. I can't live in the monastery. I can't live over here, and I can't live over here. What am I going to do? At last, something begins to occur to you. Maybe I better just give up searching around and settle down someplace. Maybe you sat down in a chair in the dining room and just put your hands in your lap and said, now what? Sighed, and there was a little opening. Maybe I should just start looking at how my mind works. Maybe I should bring these two sides of myself together. Find the whole of me. That's what Buddha's doing, not too ascetic. Finally, you know, this asceticism didn't work for him. He was with all his buddies that were trying to do this, five of them. One of them had a big spike through his tongue. One stood on one foot all day, you know, all these things punishing the body. And finally he said, it's not working. He went down and into the river finally and bathed himself. It must have felt marvelous. Imagine having your first bath after months. Just come down off a backpacking trip of 2 weeks and you get some idea how good that feels. But he was so weak he could hardly crawl out of the river. And guess who? Just then, along comes the cowherd, the young woman carrying the gruel, or what was it? It was milk and rice or something for the tree spirit. He's trying to pull himself out. I like this part. So he's trying to pull himself out of the stream. She comes along and says, oh my God, there's the tree spirit. He looks so weak, I better feed him something. So he eats something, of course, and his strength begins to come back. So much for asceticism. I can't tame the mind. I can't tame the body, and I'm still dissatisfied. I'm going to go down and sit. I'm going to sit down under that tree over there, and I ain't going to move until I understand. I don't think there's one of you in here who hasn't had that feeling. I'm going to sit down until I understand. I'm going to do this till I know something true for myself. I've heard all the teachings from other people. I remember I'm the world-honored one. Now the big day is coming. He sits down for... Get carried away here. Sits down for 7 days. And we remember on the last night, he's sitting there, and they say in the first watch of the night, this thing I mentioned earlier occurs to him. But because he's in such deep absorption, not only has he always been here, he sees that the manifestations of mind, and the various manifestations of consciousness, if you wish, appeared now as this person, now as that person. Back, 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 infinite number of births. And then he sees also that there's something that we call causation. There's a kind of chain around which delusion occurs. We call it the 12 links of causation now, and I think you're familiar with it. I'm not going to go through it all, but essentially it means this. I have sensory equipment, touch, taste, smell, so forth. There's contact with what I call phenomena of the objective world, from which arises sensation. I like it. I don't like it. And I don't know whether I like it or not. I do this. I do that. Or I do this. That, there's no other choices but those three from contact. If I grasp, either at holding something that I want to keep, or grasping at something else that I wish to avoid, and I what we would say reify that, substantiate that, turn that into a reality. That's called grasping and clinging. Out of that arises a sense of becoming. From moment to moment, since time out of mind, I have been doing that. Touching, contact, sensation, reaction to sensation as clinging, out of clinging, a new self is born. Ad infinitum, ad nauseam. Why and who is doing that and what is doing that? Where is the self in that, he asks himself. He says, well, I can see form. I can see the reaction to form, which is feelings, sensations. There's thought, perception. And out of that I build stories, formations. And there's consciousness of that whole affair. But in all of that, I cannot find what I call a self. Only a provisional self. Not a self that is autonomous and unchanging. Cannot be found. The five skandhas, which I'm sure all of you are familiar with. The five heaps. The five parts that make us up. So what is reality? He suddenly looks up. Oh, there's a storm. And I like this part. In the third watch of the night, there's a storm. Everything becomes cloudy. Everything is drenched in rain and so on. And as we're sitting this week, there's storms all week. I loved it. All these storms, and then it would clear up, and the sun would come through the window, and it's just like our life. Clarity to darkness, to clarity to darkness. Opening and closing, opening and closing. Suddenly looks up and there's the morning star. Bingo. The epiphany happens. Now what was that? I like the morning star as a symbol. The morning star, the most beautiful of all of our planets. Venus, as it rises in the old world, it was called the servant, bringing the lamp to announce the coming day, the coming enlightenment. Sees that star. Everything drops away. Everything drops away. Except just this. Just this. Just this. Who's doing it? Nobody knows. Nobody knows. Now we jump ahead 1,000 years to Zen. A lot of sutras grew up around all of this stuff. A lot of schools called the school the Madhyamaka, Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna, the philosopher of Mahayana Buddhism, said there is not even an ontological basis anywhere in the universe that we can finally understand except provisionally and conventionally through language designation or concept designation. And his famous philosophical dictum was this: whatever arises is said to be empty. By that he means empty of inherent existence. Whatever arises is said to be empty. That, meaning what I just said, that being a conventional designation is itself the middle way. So in Buddhism, there's two realities, the conventional and the ultimate. The ultimate reality is not something that we can talk about except conventionally. Conventionality depends on language, as we're using here today, which is dependently co-arisen. It's a story. We're telling each other stories. We're always telling each other stories about this. But the reality behind the story, if I talk about that reality, I have to use conventional language. And conventional language can always be, always refers to more language. Words refers to more words. Concepts to more concepts. The dropping away of all the concepts. The suchness of the emptiness of all things as this, arising now. So our practice, as I understand it, I think Shakyamuni is trying to tell us to understand it, is that the world-honored one, Buddha's birthday, is now. And is now. And is now. And is now. And if I look for now, I can't find it. And if I look for Buddha, I can't find him. So stop looking. You can't find Buddha. You'll never find Buddha by searching. So stop worrying. You can't lose Buddha. Because we are already that. That consciousness, that awareness, that presence that cannot be controverted, that cannot be examined, that cannot be found, but is already perfectly the very self, arising at this moment and passing away at this moment. You and I have always been doing this. I don't know what makes you think we won't always be doing this. So fortunately, we're getting on the bandwagon early and realizing this. The next step with that, of course, is once we understand that, we see that all craving is also dependently co-arisen. We see that the whole world is nothing but dependently co-arisen and passing away. There is no suffering except conventionally. There is no Buddha. There is no Dharma. There is no Sangha. Buddhism is about understanding that there is no such thing to reify as Buddha. Suzuki Roshi said, when Christians understand there is no Christianity, and Muslims understand there is no Allah, and Buddhism understands there is no Buddha, that's Buddhism. So to the extent that we search and try to gain something, a new identity, a more subtle form of identity, well, serving that is serving a secondary function. We are that which is already identityless. But we call it Daigon, whoever. We call it here, we call it now, we call it Palo Alto, we have all these names for it. And I think what Zen did was to bring the universality, the principle of dependent co-arising or emptiness, together with form. Form is, you know that whole thing. Form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form. Let's not get stuck on something called emptiness, reify that and go around and say, well, everything's empty, I think I'm going to go home and take a nap. When we actually realize this, the way things actually are, then you come down off the mountain and you don't spare yourself in working for the common good. So the Bodhisattva way, I'm sure the way that Gill is teaching, is that we work for one another, and it's be natural that once we understand who we really are, that we open our hearts to the world. It's just natural. You don't have to become compassionate. You are already compassion. We realize what or who we really are. However, I will say that you're also going to forget who you really are, and so am I. As soon as I get up from Zazen and turn away from the wall and put my foot down and somebody steps on it and I come off the wall like an angry ape, I'm back in this world, clutching again. But by practicing, by having these practices to do, gradually, little by little, I think we develop a kind of gap between our usual survival reactive tendencies, the old limbic system kicking in, and just watching the arising of this whole mandala of confusion, pain, horror, suffering of all kinds, indescribable suffering, grief, lamentation, bliss, any state of mind that we can think of. so that the next time somebody bumps into me, instead of, you know, hitting back immediately, there might be a moment to have some spaciousness, a little breath, to realize I'm bumping into myself. Forever bumping into myself. The big self, right? And take a breath. And bow. You know that old story about the Zen teacher sitting under a bridge in Kyoto back in the Tokugawa era. This is the 16th century sometime, maybe 17th century. He's really practicing his non-attachment. And the samurai swaggers by and everybody else bows. He doesn't bow. And the warrior comes up and looks at him and he said, "You know, I have the power to take your head off." No, he said, "You know that you're looking at somebody who has the power to remove your head?" And the monk says, "Do you know you're looking at somebody who has the power to let you do that?" And the way he said it, of course, if you're saying it from any other place, but from where he was coming from, which was total release, then you probably would have lost your head. But according to the apocryphal story, at least, the warrior was so impressed that he asked to become his disciple. Or that story of Hakuin being presented with a young mother and her irate parents, child born out of wedlock. She said, "He's the father," the old Hakuin of all people, who's the priest. He said, "He's the father, he's the daddy." "Is that so?" And Hakuin says, "Oh, also desk. Is that so?" He takes the child. It's a nice story anyway. Until the time comes when the young mother tells her parents and others, it wasn't really him. And they go get the child and they say, "Well, we're sorry, you know, we made the big mistake." And he says, "Oh, is that so? Just is that so?" There's this monk who in one of the koans comes to his teacher. I want to get the words exactly right because I kind of forgot. I wrote it down before I came here, in fact. But I knew I'd forget, so. He says to his teacher, "The body of color perishes. What is the fixed body of the Dharma?" He's talking from the universal perspective now. Probably a monk who's really experienced emptiness, the non-clinging nature. Done a lot of sitting. He says, "The body of color perishes. What is the fixed body of the Dharma?" And the old teacher says, "The mountain flowers, bloom like the mountain flowers bloom like brocade. The river between the hills is blue as indigo." So what is it? What is emptiness? The mountain flowers blooming like brocade. The river flowing like indigo between the trees. What is emptiness? The rain on the roof. A sausage for lunch. Whoops, brown rice. That's the story I tell myself today, here with you. And I tell it here with you because you're sitting there and I'm in the position to be the talker, the spokesman about something that's going on collectively among all of us. Next time it might be you sitting here, I'm sitting out there. We tell a different story. Don't take this story seriously. As soon as you hear the story, let it go. It's just the story. Somebody told us that when the wall came down in Berlin, that wall came down in, what was it, the 80s? When it finally came down? Or 90? Anyway, when it finally came down, everybody was dancing and celebrating in the streets, and somebody had made this sign in neon. It was a picture of Karl Marx, blinking on and off, and underneath in English said, Sorry, chaps, it was just an idea. This, too, that I've just told is an idea. It has no substance that you can hang on to. Thank God. Otherwise, we might go to war or something for it, to protect it, to protect our identity and our ideas. Our practice is to let it go, to appreciate it, and then goodbye. And we cry. We feel our sorrow and our pain. Becoming a bodhisattva doesn't mean that you become hardened to the world. It means your heart becomes softer and softer. The tears come more and more often. You become more and more sensitive. The wretchedness of life digs deeper and deeper into our hearts. Our frustration becomes greater and greater as we feel helpless before it. And then we sit down and sigh and open our hearts. If this practice that we all do together does not soften our hearts in some way, then it's not the Buddha Dharma. It's just more jazz, as he used to say back in the 50s. Well, I've shut off my mouth now for longer than I needed to. We can have maybe 5 minutes or so of discussion if you want. If there's anything more to be said. Anyway, it's Buddha's birthday. And when you wake up tomorrow morning, it's Groundhog Day. It's Buddha's birthday. And there is a Sufi saying, I like it. You come into the world, Sufi saying, you come into the world crying and everyone else is smiling. Oh, he said, I want to come in the world crying and everybody else smiling. I want to go out of the world smiling, everyone else crying. I like that. Finally, I have to one more poem. Wallace Stevens has a poem, if I can remember it now. It's called The Snowman. You know that one? It goes like this. One must have a mind of winter. One must have a mind of winter to regard the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow and have been cold a long time, to behold the junipers shagged with ice and the something trees stark in the distant glitter of the January sun, and not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind, in the sound of the few leaves, which is the same sound blowing in the same land for the traveler who, for the traveler in the snow, beholds nothing that is not there, and nothing that is. For the traveler who, in the snow, beholds nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is. Something like that. So we have to have the mind of winter and not be, hear any misery in the sound of the wind. Thank you.